Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Crosby Kemper. I'm the director of the Kansas City Public Library, and we're honored to have all of you here today. We're especially honored to have the Heart of America chapter of the Tuskegee Airmen, who are all seated over here, with a couple of exceptions who are over here. We're grateful to Ed King, the president of the chapter, for being here and helping us organize this. And I want to say that I'm personally grateful to Major Harvey Bayless and Major Harvey McCormick, who about 3 years ago did a program for us at the library. Colonel McGee was here a few years before that. But I knew a little bit about the Tuskegee Airmen, as I suppose most Americans do, TV movies and occasional things in print and whatnot. But the Majors Harvey showed up at the Plaza Library for a program. We kind of organized on the fly after there was a showing of a program on PBS. And we had an overflow crowd, and they were absolutely fabulous, and taught me a lot about what the Tuskegee Airmen are all about. So I want to thank them for being here. Colonel McGee has had an extraordinary career. I'm glad to say that there's some library touches to this. He met his wife Frances on library dates. It says in the biography, University of Illinois at Champaign, they went on library dates. His father later in life married a librarian, so we feel that there's some good library connections here with Colonel McGee. But it's a story of character, of what again his daughter calls in the book McGee family values, and his father was an AME minister who was also in the military in World War I and in World War II. There's a background here of family values, of religious values, of dedication to service that you can see carried out in his life. As maybe you're aware, maybe not, but but part of this extraordinary story is that he flew combat missions in World War II with the Tuskegee Airmen, in the Korean War after the armed forces had been desegregated by Harry Truman, and in Vietnam, and indeed 409 missions later, still I believe a world record. There no one has flown more combat missions than this gentleman who's in our midst today. Twenty-five Air Medals, Distinguished Flying Cross, Bronze Star. He's wearing only a small handful of the medals to which he has and decorations he has a right to wear. He also has a deep Kansas City connection. He has spent more time in Kansas City, 3 tours of duty, 20 years in retirement with his wife Frances in Kansas City. He also ran Richard Gebauer for the Air Force and the downtown Kansas City airport he ran. He has tremendous connection. He spent more time in Kansas City than anywhere else except in the air. And so we claim him as a native Kansas City, and even though he lives in near his family in Bethesda now, but he is a native Kansas City. But the thing that's most important about Colonel McGee, and this is true of the other Tuskegee Airmen, as I think you know, is that they had two fights that they fought. They fought not only the enemies of the United States, and bravely and valiantly, but also the racism and the views of African Americans that were still alive in the 1940s as they trained at Tuskegee, that they didn't have the skill, that they didn't have the intelligence, that they didn't have the ability to do what they ultimately did, and interestingly enough, and this is extraordinary to me, didn't have the courage to do it. And as this book, as Colonel McGee's life, as the life of these gentlemen who are here with us today, prove maybe once and for all that isn't true. It may be one of the great moments in American history. So the Kansas City Public Library is honored to have Colonel Charles McGee here.
Thank you very much. Ask Mr. Kemper, don't go yet, because I think a library ought to have two copies of the book. So, but I say that too also because this is an additional edition that included the award of the Congressional Gold Medal to Tuskegee Airmen for what it's meant to the country. And so I'd like you to have that.
Great. Thank you very much. For
And for those who have never seen a Congressional Gold Medal, I have a copy of one here. The original's in the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., but I'll have it here that you can come and see or have a question about a bit. I'm back home, folks, and it's so nice to look out and see not only my Tuskegee Airmen friends, but many others in the association that I had during the years that I was in and out of Kansas City and then here. And some of you may not know, the only reason I left was that my wife passed in 94, and a year later, I looked around, and I didn't have a family member within 500 miles. And so I moved east, and well, I tell folks, certainly I didn't go to Bethesda, Maryland because of the cost of living. My reason was good, and I'll have to take it. And of course, they say you can't take it with you, so I'll work that out. First of all, I'd like to congratulate the library for having the exhibit and the show, and I hope you get a chance to see. And I found out, I went and looked at it, and some of it's in the fine print, and I had to back up and get a little closer. But most of all, as I look around the audience, find a young person and take them there with you. Because that's what the story is all about. Where is America going? What are we going to be? What is our future? Do we remain number one country in the world, the strongest country in the world, with the freedoms that we enjoy and that we espouse? Mentor a young person, please. Some of the story I'm going to talk about, some of you have heard, and some of it might be the first time. But I'll go ahead and give you what I feel is good. And if I haven't, you can ask a question or run me out. But then, and somebody, it's always nice to be in a room where there's a clock on the back wall, and I don't see one. So you're at the mercy of somebody pulling my coattail if I go beyond the time allotted. I'd like to tell you the story of the Tuskegee Airmen in a way. There's a prelude to it that I'd like to give you. And we can talk about postlude and what happens after it in questions and answers, if there are any. The black experience in aviation really began before the Tuskegee experience. Jacques Ballard was a young man, ended up in France, and he was with the French Foreign Legion, and when they started their Air Corps, he joined and became a pilot. But he never flew here in America. I don't know all the reasons behind it, but he didn't. About coming behind him after the World War time frame, and I see lots of ladies here, one of the biggest influences in black aviation was a young lady named Bessie Coleman. Bessie Coleman was born in Texas, ended up in the Chicago area, but at a time that this fledgling industry in America was developing, the airplane and aviation. Bessie was very interested, realizing that there were job opportunities and interests there. But nobody, because she was a young black lady, would teach her to fly in America. With support, she went to France in 1920, came back in 1921 as really the first licensed black pilot in the world. But Bessie flew around the country barnstorming. And barnstorming that day was inviting people out, you know, might have been cow pastures, but we're out to come out to the airport and see what an airplane can do and so on. And she went around the country influencing people about this new industry and what it meant. And certainly, as a black person, out of her performances, a lot of aero clubs were developed around the country, because here in America, unfortunately, the black population was not supported in the aviation industry, and those had, whatever was done, they had to do it themselves, and that's where the aero clubs came in. Unfortunately, Bessie lost her life 1926 preparing for another air show down in Jacksonville, Florida. But I want to read something to you, because in 1925, I don't like to stand behind that, and I don't think I need to. And the light's better. 1925, this is a memorandum for the chief of staff. Folks, this is a Air War College, Army Air War College study, and the subject is use of Negro manpower in war. We were called Negro back at that time frame. They have a lot of references, but paragraph 2 says, the problem presented. So it was a problem to them that 10% of America's population, 10% of America's population was a problem. Facts bearing on the problem. The Negro is physically qualified for combat duty, but he is by nature subservient and believes himself to be inferior to the white man. He is most susceptible to the influence of crowd psychology. He cannot control himself in the fear of danger to the extent the white man can. He has not the initiative and resourcefulness of the white man. Oh, he is mentally inferior to the white man. And they have a reference for that. I haven't studied that reference. Let me jump over to what they concluded. Because of what they thought, and what they thought, or what they considered a problem, they said, yes, if America gets involved in another war, we need to use that one-tenth of the population. But, hey, we got roads to build, ditches to dig, food to cook, but not in a technical area. And, oh, by the way, blacks and whites cannot work together successfully. Therefore, they'll have to be in separate units. And, oh, because of their inferior quality, they'll have to operate under white leadership in separate units. And this, let me read two things more here. It is recommended that this study be taken as the basic policy of the War Department for the use of Negro manpower. The policies and plan for the use of Negro manpower proposed in this study are a culmination of several years' study by the faculty and student body of the Army War College. They didn't invite Bessie Coleman, but folks, that became Army policy. During the 30s, those aero clubs that I mentioned from Bessie Coleman's influence and others around Chicago, Los Angeles, there were more than 100 blacks flying aircraft. In 1936, a young man named B.O. Davis Jr. graduated from West Point and said, I want to be a pilot. They told him no. He couldn't go to school because they had no black units, so he as a black officer would have no place to go, so they're not going to train him in aviation. 1939, war clouds in Europe. America's got to rebuild itself, war industry taking place, and of course, folks, we were coming out of 10 years of depression, so everybody's interested in jobs and opportunities that could would be taking place. But they formed the civilian pilot training program at colleges around the country. This would give us a pool of pilots that our military units could draw on to provide for whatever capability we would prepare to send to Europe. Initially, that program didn't include black colleges, but of course, interest around enough. They finally, six of the so-called black colleges had the program. But pilots getting their license in the small aircraft, some going next door to the Army and saying, I want to be an Army pilot. What'd the policy say? They applied the policy. They said, no, we can't use a black pilot. We have no black mechanics. Well, pressure stayed on, and the Army said, well, we've studied the issue. It's going to fail, but you keep asking for it. We'll authorize a squadron. We'll authorize the 99th Pursuit Squadron. What's a squadron at that time? 30 pilots, 24 aircraft. Look at the fine print. Said, and all of the necessary support. Well, folks, that's a couple hundred technicians, in other words, the armors and the engine mechanics and those that actually work on the aircraft and get it in the air. And then there's, all of the support? Well, we need medical, we need administration, we need communications, we need supply. Another almost a couple hundred folks. So for that one squadron, they got trained. Now, this is a pilot program. But the Army, because of their policy saying we can't use black pilots and to have mechanics, the program was actually started at Chanute Field, Rantoul, Illinois, training the mechanics for the program. And that's where I, as a student at the University of Illinois, heard about this experiment. I had a draft card, and I knew what infantry might be like, and so, and I wasn't sure, although I was interested in engineering, they wanted to be a mechanic, so I signed up for the pilot side of the program, went and passed the exams, and was accepted, and, I was accepted in April of 42, but what happened? Well, mechanics are getting trained, got to provide for pilot training. Ooh, whites are at all these airfields all around the country, so they found $4 million to build a separate airfield. 9 miles from Tuskegee, Alabama, they began the building of Tuskegee Army Airfield, and the pilot training began in 1941. Mechanics coming down from Chanute, joined up with the pilots in 42. That first class had 12 cadets and one student officer. Now, I think you all know who that student officer was. B.O. Davis, Jr., who was turned down in 1936. But anyway, the 99th Squadron, with its support, was combat ready in December of 1942. And that was the time that I started my first flight, having finally been called up after waiting several months earlier in the year. But the 99th, being combat ready, the Army had a problem. What white commander is going to take a black unit? You got a name? Anybody tell me? Nobody. So they sent the 99th to North Africa attached to the 33rd Fighter Group. Did they go to the 33rd base? No. They went to their own base with their support, all of their support, and began operation. They would send a pilot over to the 33rd location, get their briefing, come back, fly their mission. But Colonel Mohmeyer, we need to talk about attitude. Colonel Mohmeyer didn't want them. So his reports reflected his attitude. Now, they're not aggressive. They've only, over several months, only shot down one aircraft. They're not real strong in their togetherness. And recommend they go patrol Liberia. Look at your map, folks. Where were the Germans in North Africa? And where is Liberia? Well, that was their recommendation. He did not say that their bombs on Pantelleria and their movement into Sicily, pushing the Germans out of Sicily and Italy, was equal to what everybody else was doing. But that's the way it happened. Well, we have to give you another phase of the story and come back to the 99th portion, that first phase of the Tuskegee experience. 99's going to need replacements. Can't sign a white pilot there. So training continued at Tuskegee Army Airfield. And three additional fighter squadrons came out of that training, the 100th, the 301st, and 302nd, that became the 332nd Fighter Group. Combat ready in the P-40 like the 99th, but, oh, the mission did change. You're going to fly the P-39 Bell Air Cobra. We did a little more left, still combat ready, and went directly to Italy in 1944. The time that we went to Italy was about the time that another phase of the 99th experience comes into play, because as they moved out of Sicily into Italy, they were assigned to the 79th fighter group. I mentioned attitude. Colonel Bill Bates said, fine, I've got more pilots to do the job. And if there's any early integration that took place under Colonel Bill Bates, as he, with the 99th flying with them, supporting the Anzio beachhead landing, 99th pilot shot down 17 German aircraft in 7 or 8 day time frame, again, doing the job. But later, 99th was moved back to attachment to the 33rd. And Bill Bates' approach was forgotten. I don't know whether he ever got promoted in the Army, though. The 332nd was flying Harbor, Naples Harbor, and Coastal Patrol up to the Anzio beachhead. And when in April, our bombers, now located in southern Italy, there to destroy Germany's war-making potential, were taking very heavy losses as they fly deep into German defended territory, and I think if you know the history, sometimes half of the squadron didn't get back home. They needed escort, and so 12th Tactical Air Force released units to form the 15th Strategic Air Force, and the 332nd Fighter Group was one of four groups picked to begin the support service of our B-17s and B-24s. We moved from the Naples area of Italy to the Adriatic side and began, as I say, with P-47 Thunderbolt. We had the P-47 for only about 3 months of early July, 44. All of the escort units were flying the P-51 Mustang. And let me pause this here and say, sometimes, you know, folks always like to talk to the pilots. We pilots do our thing, and it's real great. But folks, the unsung heroes are the guys that made it possible. We often forget about the mechanics and the technicians that did that. And here, these mechanics had no prior experience other than their schooling at Chanute Field. But in combat, we switched from the P-39 to the P-47, P-51, and didn't lose a day. You know, back in that day, you read the tech order, you sat in the cockpit and found where the switches were, and if the mechanic had started, that's my feeling, I'll go fly. That's part of the story. But the 332nd Fighter Group became the Red Tails. And now you know where that came from. Well, it was important that in the escort work, number one, you wanted to be clearly identifiable so that the gunners on those bombers didn't have you in their sights instead of a German aircraft. And then also, we pilots didn't want to have one of our own aircraft in our gun sights. And so we became the Red Tails. One of the other units was the Candy Stripe. Somebody else had checkerboard. We had that identification for those purposes. Well, I can say right here that Army policy had still never changed, so many of the bomber pilots did not know that Red Tails were black pilots. Now, if somebody tells you, oh, yeah, the plane flew by there, and I recognized him. You got a helmet on, goggles, and oxygen mask. Well, you can understand that story. So the story of the 99th somewhat comes to an end because in July, when the group got the switch to the P-51 Mustang, the ground war was tactical war there in Italy was very close to an end, and the 99th was assigned to the 332nd Fighter Group. So from July 44 on through the end of the war, 332nd Fighter Group had the largest fighting force under 15th Air Force, four squadrons. And your normal mission, each squadron would put up 16 aircraft. You do the math. But on to the end of the war. 332nd, along with the 33rd Fighter Group, but 332nd shot down three of the first eight ME-262s, the introduction of a jet into war in the defense of Berlin. Now, I had come home because back here, things, Army policy hadn't changed, but training was still going on. I remember when I graduated in June of 43, my instructor said, well, it's too bad they don't have a bomber program for you guys because I think you'd make a good bomber pilot. He didn't know that 3 months after him saying that, they started medium bomber training at Tuskegee Army Airfield for the Mitchell B-25. And folks, out of the production of the time that Tuskegee Army Airfield operated from 1941 to 1945-46, four squadrons for the medium bomber also came out of that program with their support. So the program produced 994 pilots. There were some liaison pilots in that group. There were a few even Haitian pilots in that group. But the over 400 of the pilots of that group did participate either in the initial deployment to Europe or as replacements for the units as they performed in Europe. Things hadn't changed here back at home because coming back home, coming down the gangplank, there were still the signs, whites this way, blacks this way. Well, what happened? Those four medium bomb squadrons were 477th Bomb Group Medium. They're training to go to the Pacific. What was their battle? Because, you know, we dropped a big bomb, training stopped. They didn't get the Pacific. But they were fighting the battle here in America to end segregation in the Army training. Because, you see, back when they, in 39 and 40, when they were drafting the laws, or preparing the laws in Congress for the draft and our participation, they didn't go ask the Army, what's your policy? They said there should be an end of discrimination based on race, creed, or color. But nobody was following that particularly. And the commander, white commander of the base where the 477th units were in training, wanted to keep segregation. Well, you know, Army regulations say officers can use the officers' club, et cetera, et cetera. He, with command approval, said, on my base, trainees will only use the facilities I designate. Well, who was in training? Well, he forgot that there was some, when he said all of the support, it wasn't all in the fighter group. There were other support people who essentially weren't training, but they were black, so they fell under his rule. Well, 101 of the officers were put in jail for trying to enter the officers' club peacefully in twos and threes. In fact, they were shipped off of the base and shipped to Godman Field, Kentucky, put behind barbed wire, and had less freedoms than German prisoners of war at the adjacent Fort Knox. Well, a quick hearing proved that Colonel Selway was wrong, because Army regulations still provide the opportunity. But the war in Europe is over now. The 332nd folks are back. Army still didn't see the light to change their policy. So what could we do? Well, it brings us to the third phase of the Tuskegee experience. We'll have a composite group. We've got all these B-25 pilots. We've got these fighter pilots coming home. We'll have a composite group. We'll call it the 477th Composite Group, keeping the 99th Fighter Squadron and two of the medium bomb squadrons. Godman Field, Kentucky is too small for the unit. What do we do? Oh, well, we'll open up Lockburn Air Base near Columbus, Ohio. It's now Rickenbacker Air Base, and assign them there. Shortly after that, training in Tuskegee, they closed the airfield. Where do we go? Well, you can go up to Lockburn. So for a while, somebody once said, well, if you ever hear that there was a black Air Force, they're talking about the years that Lockburn Air Base was the only place blacks on active duty were assigned. Year later, 1946, the Air Force became a separate service. And the Air Force in their studies did say this. They said, you know, we need to use people based on their training and experience and where needed, not the happenstance of birth, you know, color of skin. And we're not getting enough money to keep Lockburn Air Base open on an equitable basis for the mission. And very interesting, too, at that time was that the unit was assigned to the Tactical Air Command. Well, tactical, in somebody's sense, apparently meant fighters. They didn't know what to do with the B-25. So another phase of the Tuskegee experience. So from that composite group, they go back to the 332nd Fighter Group. Three squadrons only, 99th, 101st, flying P-47N. Interesting how things work. 10 months after the Air Force became that separate service, a very courageous president, Harry Truman, I think most of you know him, got lots. But he's that president that said the buck stops here. He's also the president that issued two executive orders that we can all look back and say, the experience of the Tuskegee Airmen helped him make those decisions, but he, in Executive Order 9981, mandated that all of the services shall integrate. 9980 said there should also be equal hiring and opportunity throughout the federal government. Both of these coming well ahead of the civil rights action. You know, we put names on things. So sometimes you could say, well, when you look back at it, that the Tuskegee Airmen experience was an early civil rights action. But you know, folks, and some of you in the room may know, and then many of you probably don't know, the attitudes around the country at that time with laws that were on the books in most states and so on felt that any time you get a group of blacks together, there's got to be problems. And the same attitudes that the War College had, that dealing blacks and whites together is a problem. Hopefully, you can see that the accomplishment of the Tuskegee Airmen, now called Tuskegee Airmen, why? Because all of our training took place at Tuskegee. We didn't go down as Tuskegee Airmen, but that's a resultant. We like to hang names on things, as I say. That experience proves something. What the Army War College said was a problem, and what they called facts, I put them down as biases, generalizations, and in some cases just outright racism. Were they facts in your mind? When you can look at what the training program produced and what was accomplished during the war years, and how does that story end? Well, let me bring up one fact. The Air Force held its first Top Gun gunnery meet in 1949. I think all of you know Top Gun's a big thing in the Air Force, you know, who's the best shooters and all of this. That program's always held out in Arizona. You know, we've got lots of wide open space. Let me jump ahead just a bit. In the 1970s, Air Force history is building, and they began to publish some of their history. And when they started publishing the story of the Top Gun, they had 1949 unknown. Guess who were the Top Guns? Shouldn't be hard for a guess. It was pilots of the 99th of the 332nd Fighter Group flying those P-47Ms. Fortunately, several of the pilots still living had pictures, had their trophies. And by the way, the trophy was found 2 years ago in the basement of the Air Force Museum. But they let it be known. Things began to change. Korean War time frame put out. What did the Air Force do? July of 49, they closed Lockburn Air Base. And those of us scattered around the world, those of us there on active duty, were scattered around the world. Now, does the story end there? Not really, because there are hundreds of stories of the experience of those airmen and those officers and their families as they faced what America was still offering as the years went on. And why do I say that? Had folks awakened and made different decisions, we wouldn't have had that civil rights era. It took some action by Congress, Plessy versus Ferguson and Brown versus, what was it, Topeka Board of Education, beginning to change attitudes. And our country began to take a hold that, hey, we are a very, very diverse country. And if we're going to stay the number one country in the world and enjoy the freedoms that we do, all citizens need equal access and equal opportunity to what we offer. And I also put it this way as we're dealing and looking at our young folks and so on. I think all of you have heard the story that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. How do we, as Americans, remain strong if we keep producing weak links? Keep letting it happen. Now you know, I hope, why I say, when you go to the exhibit, find a youngster and take them along with them. Share the story. I think we may have time for a question or two, and as I say, I'll have the gold medal up here for those that want to come and see it. But you've done a good job.
Folks, we're recording this. We're recording the audio. So if you have a question, just raise your hand. I'll come over with the microphone so we can get it on tape.
Colonel McGee, you flew a lot of combat missions. How did you and your comrades get mentally prepared to go into battle knowing that this may be your last battle? What was the mental preparation?
Well, number one, I was saying, fortunately, even though the Army expected the program to fail, they didn't change the standards. We had excellent training. We were prepared for the type of task that we would face. And, of course, we individually want to be accepted for how we perform. So, okay, where do you set the standard? Mine was always do your best in whatever you're doing, and that helped along the way. There are 10 years I always feel that prepare everybody for their future. In the time frame we were talking about, the country, and I think I may have mentioned it, came out of 10 years of depression. So what were the attitudes? Everybody was eager. We were, even though there was segregation, we were more American. to do the jobs in the plants, to better ourselves, and so on. Kind of not out front focus, but yet a push that everybody was moving in the same direction, and essentially for the same reason. Now, I fell in love with aviation, and I tell young folks, I hope everybody prepares themselves and finds a job they enjoy doing, because I don't think there's anything better than going to work every day and liking what you're doing. So I enjoyed, I made mine a military career. Now, I do have to say that in the late 50s, when I might have aspired to become an airline pilot, well, they just weren't ready. So I stayed in the military. But yeah, it took some lawsuits in the early 60s, as you know, for them to begin to give folks equal access. Hope that partially answers your question.
As a friend of Colonel McGee, who celebrated his 90th birthday recently. I was a member of his staff, his officer staff at Richard Scabari, the first black wing commander at Richard Scabari Air Force Base. And he also shot down a German ME-109. Carried the torch, an Olympic torch, in Atlanta. And lastly, at the Rose Bowl parade, he was on the Tuskegee Airmen float in West Covina.
Well, you have to keep yourself active, folks. You can.
When I've studied this period of history, I came across the term and was taught double V.
What is the double
V? Double V for victory abroad and victory at home.
Yes.
Were you familiar with the phrase at the time, and did you all use it amongst yourselves?
That phrase came out of the black press, because that was our focus at the time. There was discrimination around, and with us going to war, there were those folks that said, hey, blacks participation or Negro participation has two meanings. One, we're fighting to get rid of Nazism in Europe, and number two, hopefully get rid of racism here at home. You see, back then there were still laws on the books in the South that a Negro could be lynched and nobody could do anything about it because it was the way of life. That was the double V. That little action by the 477th pilots who peacefully tried to change the focus with another little fight there in that victory against racism here at home. So it was, as I say, but it started in the black press and was, so we were aware of it because the newspaper and the reporters let us know. And folks, everything doesn't run smoothly like all this went just very nice. Because at that time, you know, I mentioned Congress had passed a law with the draft that there should be equal opportunity based on race, not, you know, creed or color. There were those that wanted integration now. And there were those that said that this action by the Army to only authorize a squadron and locate everything there, that's still discrimination. Well, in a way it was, because we weren't working together as a team of Americans. Well, we've come a long ways.
Colonel McGee, in reading from history, I'm over here. Is it true that there was a particular group of bombers that said they didn't want to fly unless they had the protection of the 99th because you guys never lost a unit of bombers?
I'm glad you brought that subject up. First of all, folks, when you use the term never, you've got to qualify. Somebody said that to Colonel Davis, when you were there. So neat, you guys have never lost a bomber. That's not a good statement. It would have to be qualified. If you could say in 130 missions you never lost one, you can stand on that. Somebody say in 200 missions? Mm-mm. The review of the record shows there were some escort times that bombers were reported lost due to enemy fighters. Now, takes a lot of research. How long is the mission? You're up in the air. Well, we're 4.5, 5, 6 hours. That time frame was 2 hours of that. Where were you? Who was it? There's just lots of questions. The fact does show there, and folks that say never, cut the word out. If you say that the 332nd had a very creditable record, far exceeding what everybody else was doing, you can stand on it.
Colonel, I'm over here.
And there's one in the center here. When you get to him, he keeps asking, yes, sir.
Thank you for your service to our country. The black graduates out of West Point that went into the officers' corps that weren't in aviation, were they? Can you name any that were instrumental in progressing the Air Corps?
Well, the Tuskegee Airmen program produced 3 general officers. One was non-rated flying, who worked in finance, General Theus. He's passed on. B.O. Davis and General James. Chappie James became the first 4-star general. B.O. Davis received his 4-star in retirement. Relating to the academy, I don't know that I could answer the question in the way that you put it. There have been a number of graduates. Is there equity, if you will, in minority population in all of the academies? I think the answer is no. But this goes back to how are we mentoring our young folks? How are we preparing them for their future, and their future is the country's future? You know, well, I don't want to get on counselors, but there are too many counselors in the school to tell the young lady, you don't want to be an architect. Young ladies make good architects. But I've got one granddaughter that is one, and I know. My son, right here, out here in Belton, had a counselor tell him, you don't want to get into aeronautics. He graduated with an aeronautical degree from Kansas University and is about to retire as an airline captain, instructor. Folks, we need to do a lot of thinking about, you know, teachers are underpaid. And there are probably some there that shouldn't be paid. We need a system. One of the things about the service was that if you stayed in, you're graded all the time. What's wrong with grading teachers all the time? And if they aren't cutting the mustard, sorry, but you find some other source of work. Folks, that's important to where our country's going. We're more diverse now than we were then. What are we doing about it to assure that we aren't just putting out weak links? Enough said. Yes, sir. Can you get this gentleman, when you get through, he's been raising his hand here in the jacket. Raise your hand so he knows where to. Okay, he'll bring you the microphone, but it's over here now. Yes, sir.
Colonel McGee, I understand that when the program was beginning in Tuskegee, that Eleanor Roosevelt was supportive and may have said some things and done some things that aided with moving the program along. Is this true? And if it is, could you share a little bit about that?
Glad to, because that brings up the movie, the HBO movie about the Tuskegee Airmen. In the movie, Eleanor Roosevelt goes down to Tuskegee and flies with a cadet. Do you think that would really happen? Eleanor Roosevelt went to Tuskegee on a Rosenwald Fund meeting, and while there, because Tuskegee Institute had a very excellent civilian pilot training program going on, flew with Charles Alfred Anderson. Who was Charles Alfred Anderson? Remember I mentioned Bessie Coleman's influence and things going on in the 30s? He was a self-taught pilot, got a license in 1932. He headed, when the black universities came in the CPT program, he became a senior instructor at one and ended up at Tuskegee, and that's who she flew with. She went back to Washington. Well, the story goes that her escort all didn't, don't want to do that, do you? Don't really. They wanted to call the president. And the president said, if she wants to fly, she goes to fly. But she went back and did have the influence tell the Army, Chief Anderson flew just like these other pilots that are flying me around. Why are you dragging your feet to help get that 99th approval?
Colonel, I'd like to thank you for an excellent program. Enjoyed it thoroughly. But I also want to thank you for your work in Italy in 1944. You see, I was one of those bomber pilots. I got shot down, but not by enemy aircraft. It was by anti-aircraft gun. I also would like to say that that may have been a secret, but as far as the two pilots on our bomber, we knew those were black pilots up there. And we were happy to have them up there. We'd have liked to have a few more. I like to say that it was rather difficult to keep a secret when we bomber pilots could listen to the radio and we find that somewhere or another some enemy aircraft were after a bomber. The pilot wanted some help and he called for some help, and you hear over the radio the reply that comes back. Sounded a great lady like Rochester of Jack Benny fame. Said, yes sir, boss, coming right down.
This is our final question here.
Oh.
There we go.
I got to quit waving my arm. Yes,
Colonel McGee. As a caveat to the questions asked over there about the graduates of West Point, I want you to know that my son went to high school over with Bishop Hogan, and when he announced that he wanted to go to West Point, they told him, well, that's a little, you know, far-fetched, and you ought to think about something else. Well, he went to West Point, and he is now is a graduate of West Point, and now a professor at UMKC. So those things are possible.
Thank you. Stand up. Well, folks, I heard them say that was going to be the last question. You've been a very kind audience, and I'd say God bless you, God bless America, and please mentor a youngster.